inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. I'm Walker Wildman. It's our new edition of the program. Glad to have you with us for this week here on American Family Radio. Thank you to everyone who donated to our Share-a-thon last week. We had a great week, and it was great because thousands of you called in and donated to our Share-a-thon. And so we appreciate you. Thank you very much for everyone who participated. And Lord willing, we'll stick around for another year to come here, American Family Radio, broadcasting around the country, all around the world through our AFR app. And it's only made possible because of you. So thank you to everyone who stepped up and donated. Thank you to everyone who stepped up and donated. And as a reminder, for those maybe new to the network, we are listener supported. So without you, we're not here. And but thankfully, you donate, you give generously. And for that, we're thankful. And we're going to be able to stick around for years to come, Lord willing. Let's turn our attention to the scripture. We're in Proverbs chapter 6 this week. There's a lot of wisdom here. A lot of wisdom, a lot of wisdom about parenting, about the role of a mother and father, about the wisdom they pass on to a son or to a daughter. But the last two verses are what stood out to me, because it's applicable no matter the relationship, whether it's a familial relationship, a parental relationship, whatever the relationship is. Listen to this. For jealousy, this is verse 34 in chapter 6 of Proverbs. For jealousy enrages a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not accept any ransom, nor will he be satisfied, though you give him many gifts. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 34 and 35 says that the jealous man will not be satisfied, though you give many gifts. And what we see here is that jealousy, which, by the way, is the 10th commandment, is to not covet your neighbor's goods or family or spouse, etc. But what we see here is that it boils down to a heart issue. Just like many of the issues in Scripture, and ultimately the sin issue is a heart issue. But jealousy clearly is a heart issue. Why do we know it's a heart issue? Because the proverb says here in verse 35 that basically, I'm summarizing, it doesn't matter what you give the jealous man. It doesn't matter what you give the jealous man, quote, he will not be satisfied, though you give him many gifts. And that's what we find throughout Scripture, is God continues to point towards the human heart. And ultimately, God has to change the heart. And that's why Jesus came, to change the heart. And that's what the Holy Spirit does when we receive salvation, is the Holy Spirit works in our lives and in our hearts to change the way, not only the way we think about things, but also the way our heart processes things and situations. That's only the power of God that can do that. So Proverbs 6, verse 34 and 35, and of course, you look over at Exodus chapter 20, you see the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet, which goes well with that proverb. All right, let's turn our attention to some of the news of the week. And before we do that, I want to highlight some events. We have the Activate Summit, which this is actually our promo week. We've been talking about it for a couple months now, but we're going to hit it pretty heavy. This week, we're going to have on Ed Vitagliano, who's one of the speakers at the summit. But the summit is in June, the 12th through the 14th. And we've only got a little while left before registration closes, probably a week or two thereabouts before registration closes for the summit. The summit dates, once again, are 12th through the 14th of June. If you want to know more, just go over to afa.net/events, afa.net/events, and you can get not only the Activate Summit link, but also the AFA at the ARC link, which is coming up in October. We also have the Weekend with AFA link, which is in October as well. So we've got several events there over at the events page at afa.net/events, and you can check all of those events out, all of the dates, all of the pricing, all the speakers, everything over at afa.net/events. Well, I've got a couple clips here if we can get to some of them. This first one is a recap of the stunning border numbers since President Trump was sworn in January 20th of this year. The border numbers have just plummeted. The border crossings and the border apprehensions and the gotaways, all of the numbers have dropped 90%+ to where the Trump administration has full operational control of the border. And the deportations are happening. The repatriations technically are happening, where they're arrested at the border for illegal crossing, and then they're repatriated within hours, if not within a couple of days. Let's listen to this Fox report on the stunning border numbers under the Trump administration.
Our voter analysis team went out and found this. 75% of the people said that they are supported. That was the single most important factor in their vote. When you're at 75% in America, all right, 50-50 nation, that's Republicans and Democrats and independents alike. And you mentioned the border crosses. In March, 7,000. That's a stunner. And then you get to the headline from the LA Times, California-Mexico border, once overwhelmed, now nearly empty. And that's where we are. And we say it a lot, you know, once you fix a problem, people forget about it. But this is a big change.
It's a stunner, Bill. It really is. And for all of the talk, remember, of President Biden saying, I've done all I can do, and the administration and the Biden administration saying you have to have congressional action and a piece of legislation to be able to change the numbers on the border. What we've seen just in a few weeks is the numbers have changed significantly by the actions, executive actions of the Trump administration.
We were lied to. That's the only conclusion you can draw from that. We were lied to. Biden told us, and these are the wounds that we can't forget. These are the wounds that we can't forget. We were lied to for 4 years. Our country was accosted and invaded, and people died. And that's not an exaggeration. Talk to all the victim families of illegal immigrants that committed gruesome crimes against American citizens, including murder. Talk to the women and children that were trafficked. Illegal entry into this country, folks, is not a victimless crime, which is a common talking point of the radical left Marxists in our country that want to destroy it from the inside out. Oh, it's a victimless crime. No, it's not. The first victim is our country as a whole when you invade our nation, because you're striking at our sovereignty. But President Biden told us, I can't do anything about it. Got to have Congress get involved. Well, of course, Congress isn't going to do anything. And the one thing they wanted to do under Biden was terrible. The law, the bill that was proposed, where they had some Republicans sign on to it, including Senator Lankford and others. Terrible bill. Terrible. They were going to basically give Biden a quota where he could basically reach a quota of a good, what's a good number of illegal immigrants per day? No. Zero is a good number. And so our border was invaded. Our country was invaded. That's why one of the reasons President Trump won. And President Biden lied to us straight up. Like, there's some things that are said where it's like, is that a lie, or is he misspeaking, or does he just not know what he's talking about? But whoever told President Biden that he had no operational control over the border was straight up lying to him. And there actually should be an investigation, I think. I think we need to know who told the president of the United States that he had no operational control over the border. We got to get Congress involved. We're spending record numbers on Department of Homeland Security, and you can't control the border? Here's the number differential. By the way, the only thing that changed is who's in the White House, okay? Between these numbers. The only thing that changed is who's in the White House and who sets the policy for the executive branch. In El Paso, for the El Paso region, for the El Paso sector, there were 32 encounters. This article was on March 28th, so a couple weeks ago. On a single day, there were 32 encounters in El Paso, Texas, compared to 1,134 encounters the same day in 2024. This is in a 24-hour period. 97% reduction. In Tucson, Arizona, there were 59 apprehensions on this same day in March, compared to 1,222 on the same day last year under Biden. A 95% reduction. San Diego, 36 apprehensions on Thursday, this is back in March, compared to 908 on the same day in 2024, a 96% decrease. In total, there were 254 apprehensions across the entire southern border in March, on this day in March. This is a one-day, 24-hour period, compared to 4,229 on the same day under Biden, a 94% reduction. But Biden promised us, he told us, the American public, when it comes to the scandal at the border, we need Congress to get involved. We need Congress to get involved. And you want to know why they wanted Congress to get involved? I'll tell you two reasons why they wanted Congress to get involved, why Biden wanted to blame it on Congress. Number one is politics. Let's pass the buck over to Congress. Instead of taking care of something that is a core, critical, fundamental, basic function of the executive branch, which is to control those who flow into our country and those who flow out, he wanted to pass the buck to Congress because it was politically expedient and he didn't want to do anything about it. So let's just blame Congress. Which, blaming Congress is like 535 people. You're going to blame Congress. Who are you blaming in Congress? It's got 535 people, representatives, between the Senate and the Congress. And we want to blame Congress? When you've got a multi-billion Department of Homeland Security budget and you have full operational authority, according to the Constitution, to control the entry of individuals into our country, and you want to blame it on Congress? When you stop the border wall, you stop the border wall. Biden sent a memo down to the Department of Homeland Security to stop building the border wall, even though the money was there. Oh, and it's Congress's fault. The media should have called him on that instantly. Instantaneously, he should have been called on that. The second reason is Washington loves spending our money. They're addicted to spending our money. And every time there's a problem, they think passing another spending bill is going to fix the problem. You want to know why? Because that's an easy way to get kickbacks. It's an easy way to engage in insider trading. You want to know why? Because they know which all companies are going to get awarded all the money in the spending bills. And what do? They buy the stocks right before they pass the bill. This happens all the time. Anytime there's a crisis, even though it's a Biden-created crisis, oh, we need to pass the bill. We need more money. Y'all need more money so you can give it to your buddies so y'all can get kickbacks and get campaign donations. We know how this thing works. We've seen this circus so many times, it makes my head spin. So the truth is that the only reason we had a problem with illegal immigration is because Biden sat on his hands for 4 years. We'll be back.
The This Easter season, we're offering a special downloadable resource that will inspire you and deepen your faith. He Is Risen is a digital booklet featuring powerful articles from The Stand and AFA Journal that explore the life-changing truth of the resurrection, the significance of Easter, and how to share these foundational truths with others. For a limited time only, it's our gift to you for any donation of $5 or more. Help us continue to share biblical truth, defend Christian values, and equip our families. Visit afr.net/offers.
At the Core podcasts are available at afr.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the second segment of the program today. Walker Wildman here with you. Glad to have you with us on the program. As a reminder, we love those who subscribe to our podcast. Well, we love everyone who listens to the program, but we do appreciate those who subscribe to the podcast. Just type in the name of the program, At the Core, in your podcast library and click the subscribe button once you find the show page. Then, when you do that, the show will be queued up in your library, in your inbox, each and every day, and make it convenient and quick for you to listen to past episodes or go back and listen to maybe you missed part of an interview. All of that convenience is there by subscribing to the At the Core podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Well, I want to jump to our next guest, Congressman Eric Burleson from Missouri, serving the 7th Congressional District since 2023. He's with us now. Congressman Burleson, welcome to the program.
Great to be on.
Well, Congressman, there's a lot we can talk about in Washington, especially with the Trump presidency, a lot of different directions we can go. But I wanted to start out talking a little bit of DOGE and a little bit of fiscal talk and spending. The DOGE is basically an office within the White House, within the executive branch, that is working with not only Congress, but with all the agencies at cutting wasteful spending and fraudulent spending across the entire executive branch. But tell us Congress's role here, because we get what's going on from the White House vantage point, but tell us what role the Congress and specific maybe some committees are doing to work with DOGE and make some of these spending cuts permanent.
Yeah, well, you know, part of what DOGE is doing is really uncovering this information and identifying where there is potential waste, and then they are taking action, but none of this will be made permanent unless Congress takes action. And so we've got to work alongside DOGE. I'm on this subcommittee, the DOGE subcommittee that's being chaired by Marjorie Taylor Greene. And when we met with Elon and his team, we kind of came to an arrangement where they will continue to work. Basically, they're doing a forensic audit. They will identify places to find, you know, opportunities for waste, fraud, and abuse. And then they'll bring it to us. We will have hearings on it and expose it and then suggest legislation to correct it, whether it's policy changes or just zeroing out appropriations and asking the Appropriations Committee to do that. So they have been very successful. They uncovered that there's been $2.7 trillion that has been lost in improper payments since 2003. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of money. Imagine instead of being 6.7 trillion dollars in debt, we'd be 34. I mean, that's nothing to blink. I mean, that's quite a bit. I mean, it's a big difference. So we wouldn't have to be increasing the debt ceiling, to give you an idea.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of potential savings. The question is, will Congress have the political courage to do the right thing and to do the difficult thing? And it's yet to be seen, because politicians are politicians, right? And so they need the backbone.
Well, you're reading my mind, because I've been doing this. I'm still a young guy, but I've been doing this long enough to over a decade to figure out how the game works. And getting Congress to do something long term here is to me the big hurdle, because we have Republicans control both chambers, the House and the Senate, and of course we have a Republican president, but your margins there are very small. And so let me ask you this: can some of these long-term budgetary changes, let's say deductions are you know, however you want to describe cutting these funds that are no longer needed at the executive level, can this happen in the reconciliation package, the one big bill that they're talking about? Can some of these changes happen in that package, or is this going to have to happen elsewhere?
Yeah, there's some that can happen. So to understand this, let me put it in a little bit of context. There is reconciliation is only pertaining to mandatory spending. So it doesn't include discretionary spending. And the distinction is that mandatory spending are things that Congress doesn't necessarily appropriate. It's things like the number of people on Medicaid and the amount of money going out to the states for Medicaid. It's the number of people on Social Security and Medicare. So we don't actually appropriate those because we've got in policy that a policy that basically gives access to those funds regardless of whether we appropriate them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, those bills get paid no matter what because y'all said so.
Right. And then you've got discretionary spending. So reconciliation by definition can only include mandatory spending other than Social Security. You can't touch Social Security and reconciliation. So that basically leaves Medicaid and Medicare. It also has, you know, a lot of these green energy tax credits because the tax credits are out there as a mandatory spending. If somebody builds a solar farm, we don't appropriate the dollars. They just get to claim the tax credit. So what we can do in this reconciliation package is change the policies. For example, the Green New Deal tax credits, we could eliminate those programs or at least wind them down over the next coming years and then identify those savings. And when it comes to Medicaid, that's going to be one of the, you know, that and actually the green energy tax credits are going to be a fight. And you've got some Republicans that have sent letters, moderates that have sent letters to the speaker saying that they won't support cutting the green energy tax credits. I mean, that's surprising, but like they want to dig in their heels on a Joe Biden era on programs that Joe Biden created, and then they are digging in their heels about any kind of cuts to Medicaid. So we've got a fight on our hands within the Republican Party.
Yeah, and the talking points on this, number one, to your point, opposing cuts to the Green New Scam is absurd from a Republican vantage point. I mean, that was a left wing Bondugel bill that funds all their left wing wish list items that are very anti-American. I mean, this a lot of this stuff comes from China, and so that doesn't make any sense. And then secondly, a lot of the other stuff, like saying we're not going to do Medicaid cuts. Medicaid cuts. Well, there's a lot of that's a blanket statement without really having an articulative or a common thoughtful discussion, because just saying out of the box we're not going to touch it. What if there's fundamental problems with the system?
Yeah.
Like fraudulent ways that people are getting paid that Congress hasn't weighed in yet. To me, just to dismiss touching Medicaid is problematic.
I totally agree. I couldn't agree more. In fact, when you look back at the Medicaid program, it was originally designed to take care of the aged, blind, disabled, and pregnant mothers and children, okay, in poverty. Mm-hmm. So you've got, that was what Medicaid was intended to do, is cover the healthcare costs for that population, the most vulnerable population. Then Obama came in, and in Obamacare, they expanded it to the able-bodied working adults, or they expanded that population, how much money they could make. And as a result, we now have a lot more people that are working age, but are not working to their fullest extent so they can qualify for Medicaid. In addition, you have the Biden era when Joe Biden came in, especially during COVID, he used COVID as an excuse to issue a ton of executive orders that loosen the regulations on Medicaid so that people don't, for example, have to re-enroll. They don't have to, you know, once they've qualified for Medicaid, they'll stay on it for life under Joe Biden's policies. And so we have got to correct that, because now in the Medicaid program, the able-bodied young adult population, people that should be working, people that we desperately need to enter the workplace because we are, we are correctly sending back home all these people that are here illegally that are doing a lot of this labor work.
Yeah.
We need the working age young population to get, you know, out of their parents' basement and get to work,
yeah,
and get off of Medicaid. So that is the largest now population on Medicaid. Just re-implementing the work requirements rules under Bill Clinton, which Biden has waived, just doing that alone will save almost $150 billion. There's other things that we could do within Medicaid. For example, California, New York, these states are aggressively manipulating the formula to basically launder money from the federal government. So what they're doing is they're going to hospitals and managed care systems, the insurance companies for the states, and they're saying, we're going to tax you, say 15%, and then you raise your rates, you raise your cost to us by 20%, and then we will draw that down from the federal government in the 90-10 match.
Yes.
In other words, the state is out of pocket, no money, and in fact, they're profiting. So California, there's a report that was done by Epic where California was able to bring in an additional $9 billion on basically make $9 billion from the federal government on their Medicaid program, and they used that $9 billion to pay for the illegal immigrant population.
Yeah, that's infuriating.
Close those doors.
Yeah. Yeah, that's infuriating. Let me ask you this, and then before we move on and change subjects, because I'm getting a little worked up the more you talk. The Impoundment Control Act, this goes back to the 70s. Does the president, is this pretty cut and clear from the legal vantage point that the president can, as long as Congress hasn't specifically designated it to be spent, if there's some discretion in there, can the president pause a lot of this funding and just hold it and maybe send it back to the Treasury?
I truly think that the Impoundment Control Act was unconstitutional. And I think that the Congress can designate the money, but once we appropriate it, it's under the executive branches to carry it out. And if they decide, you know, that they can accomplish the objective with less dollars, or that there's fraud occurring, they shouldn't have to be forced to spend every dollar that's been appropriated. But that's why we're in this horrible situation that we're in, because ever since the Impoundment Control Act, you've got departments that they get to the end of the year and they didn't need to spend all that money. So guess what they do? They just blow money on crazy things.
You know?
I was in a meeting the other day in an empty building that was huge. I mean, this thing was hundreds of thousands of square feet office building that's near the Capitol building. It's where the Voice of America was once located. All this broadcast technology is in the building. When we were in the room, I looked up the chair that I was sitting in, and it was a $2,900 office chair, like very expensive, top of the line chair. The microphone that I was talking to had its own video monitor on it. It was wireless. I looked that up, and $1,600 microphone. And ironically, whenever I was given my 5-minute questions, my microphone stopped working in the middle of my 5 minutes. So that's government for you. That's government for you. So this agency, Voice of America, they had a bunch of money at the end of the year. And guess what they did? They left this nice space, leased an even more posh space in downtown DC for a lease of $250 million. $250 million. And so we're paying for this empty building that the federal government owns, and we're giving them money to lease like a separate space because apparently that building wasn't good enough. This is the kind of crazy expenditures that happens when you let people spend other people's money without any kind of control whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah, I just want to encourage, once again, we've been talking to Congressman Eric Burleson from the state of Missouri, serving the 7th Congressional District. Congressman, I, you know, We're behind you guys, especially over on the House side, some of the Freedom Caucus members and the other conservatives in the House. I mean, the American people, when you look at the surveys on this, the American people, even Democrats, overwhelmingly support the stuff you guys are talking about here. I mean, cutting wasteful spending, downsizing government, these are largely, when you're talking about the voters, these are largely bipartisan issues. Now, if you go talk to Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer, they're going to say, oh, we need to keep it all. But if you go talk to actual voters on the ground that aren't political hacks, they're going to say, yeah, I mean, of course, we don't need to be funding this stuff when we're in debt up to our eyeballs. So I just want to challenge you guys to keep up the good fight. And we got this two-year window. I mean, you guys know this. We've got this two-year window. We don't know what's going to happen in the midterms. We don't know what's going to happen with the Senate. We can be optimistic, and that's fine, and we need to work hard. But we got 30 seconds left, but we got a two-year window for you guys to really move the ball down the field. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that we've got really one chance to save this country. When Ray Dalio was on Meet the Press, and I think, I mean, he's a trusted advisor. He knows the economics of this. We are facing a debt spiral as a nation. We're at the precipice. This is the last chance, I think, that we're going to have to actually turn this country around.
Yeah, I agree 100%. That's why I want to challenge folks, not just Congress, but voters to stay engaged, folks. I mean, this is getting President Trump in the White House is just like the opening salvo here. This is not, we're far from over. When it comes to the fight to save this country. Hey, Congressman, thanks so much. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you. God bless.
Appreciate that. That's Congressman Burleson from Missouri, covering the 7th Congressional District. He's been in office since 2013. Former Missouri House Representative there in the state of Missouri, State House Representative. And I appreciate his time coming on the program. Well, he's a fighter. And there are other fighters in Washington, and there's some good people up there working hard. So we got to support them. We got to provide cover fire for them. And we got to push them in the right direction, folks. I mean, they call it the swamp for a reason. So we just got to keep pushing them in the right direction. And we can't grow weary in doing good. We'll be back.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to the program. In the last segment, if you missed part of it, we were talking to Congressman Eric Burleson from the state of Missouri about what Congress is doing to work with the White House and DOGE to cut spending from a variety of programs. And he was, unfortunately, giving us a glimpse into even some of the Republican dissent on spending cuts, and it's absolutely infuriating. The Democrats, they all get on the same page when they're in charge, and the Republicans are not on the same page when they're in charge. And so they're going to have to figure it out, because the direction our country's headed in is not a good one, and they're going to have to figure it out because the ball's in their court. I mean, they're the majority now, so there's no more blaming the Democrats. Republicans are in the majority, so they're going to have to figure that out. Let's move on to our next subject and our next guest. We have on with us now Tessa Cox. Tessa is a senior research associate over at the Charlotte Loser Institute, and we've had various representatives on there from the Charlotte Loser Institute before, so we're glad to have them back. Tessa, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, Tessa, I want to talk abortion funding for abortion providers. And I use that word because most people say Planned Parenthood, and that is the majority of the money. But when you're talking about the law and policy, you can't really target entity names. We have to target what's fundamentally going on here. And that is, there's a lot of federal tax dollars going to abortion providers in this country. So give us a breakdown of where this money's coming from and what kind of dollar amount we're talking about.
Sure, yes. So in the U.S., federal Medicaid can't cover abortion in most cases. So in most circumstances, you're not allowed to use federal Medicaid to pay for an abortion. However, federal Medicaid can cover other services, other things that a lot of these large abortion businesses, including Planned Parenthood, do. And of course, we know that this helps underwrite their bottom line, help enable their priorities. And of course, especially when you're talking about groups like Planned Parenthood, we know that their priority is abortion. And so Planned Parenthood alone reports nearly $700 million in taxpayer funding every year. And the bulk of this is coming through the Medicaid program. And Planned Parenthood is able to bill for other services that it does, like the pregnancy test, STD testing, many services that might be done in conjunction with an abortion. And we can see from their annual reports that abortion is their main priority. Even as other services have been falling, abortions have been going up. And so the taxpayer funding that they receive helps to allow them to focus on their priorities, which is abortion.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the amendment, the Hyde Amendment, they call it, which is supposed to prevent federal funding to abortion, to cover abortion. It's really been a weak kind of tool, if you will, a regulation that is basically the abortion providers have found every way from Sunday to work around it. And to your point, we're covering the light bill. We're covering every procedure and every medication and everything leading up to the abortion itself. We're paying for a lot of the post-abortion procedures or whatever's involved after the abortion. So they're basically billing the federal government for everything but the one code that is the abortion code in the system, if you will, if you know how insurance works and billing works. And it just seems so weak. I mean, when you look back on it, and I'm not saying, I mean, I better have the Hyde Amendment than nothing, but we got to do better than this. I mean, my rule would be if you do abortions at all, if abortions are offered at all under your entity, you're not getting federal money.
Well, it's certainly, like you said, better to have the Hyde Amendment than not, because we know that the Hyde Amendment has saved lives, millions of lives, just because it's preventing taxpayer funding from going to abortion in many cases. But at the same time, the fact that Planned Parenthood is doing abortions, that these large abortion businesses are doing abortions, and that's not really even the only concern. We've just seen this pattern of substandard, shoddy care from Planned Parenthood, obviously leading to the deaths of unborn babies, but tragically harming and even leading to the deaths of their mothers as well. There was the recent case in Colorado where a young woman died after a botched abortion, 18 years old. There's the recent New York Times expose with former Planned Parenthood staffers coming forward and pointing to the shoddy care that was being offered at Planned Parenthood. Mm. Botched abortions, sewage leaking into the recovery room, just these horrendous conditions, all while Planned Parenthood was using profits to promote advocacy, promote abortion, instead of putting it into its centers.
Yeah.
So really, there is this concerning standard that we've seen in abortion centers, including a lot of the ones that are run by Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, this, when you look at Planned Parenthood as a whole, and this is looking at it objectively, not just from a partisan lens, they're basically a quasi-Democrat government pro-abortion entity. I mean, they're hardcore left. They, to your point, a lot of this money that goes to Planned Parenthood ends up getting funneled back into political campaigns, all Democrats for the most part, maybe a few Republicans if they commit to be pro-abortion in their policymaking. But this is basically a Democrat machine, Democrat pro-abortion machine that is being funded, at least in part, subsidized by the federal government. And when you look at the amount of money that they get from private contributions, this is staggering. Just in the 2022-2023 numbers, which is some of the numbers you mentioned earlier about their funding, they got almost $1 billion in private contributions. So they're getting this is worse than the university setting where they say we're a government university, but yet we get endowments to the tune of billions. Planned Parenthood is doing the same thing. $1 billion in private contributions in the 2022-2023 report. This is crazy. I mean, to me, they need to pick. Are you a government? Are you a government entity or are you a private entity? And you really can't have it both ways. But unfortunately, Tessa, they've got it both ways right now.
Well, you're absolutely right that Planned Parenthood has been reporting record profits, record income, and that includes a huge stockpile of private donations. Certainly in the months after Dobbs, a lot of people were fired up and they gave a lot of money to Planned Parenthood. So it's a very wealthy organization. And a lot of the large abortion chains benefited from that. A lot of them brought in a lot of money. There were lots of donations that were happening. So these are not some small outfits. These are large, well-funded professional organizations. And just looking at that recent New York Times article, they're not putting that money into healthcare. To a large extent, and this is according to their own staff, they're putting it into advocacy and promoting abortion. And so a lot of that record income isn't being reflected in the actual standard of care that they're providing.
Yeah, you guys over at Charlotte Loser, once again, we're talking to Tessa Cox, one of their senior research associates at the Charlotte Loser Institute. One of the reports you guys put out, and a lot of this is just looking at what Planned Parenthood is publishing publicly. But to your point, over the last, let's just say, decade or so, their patient count has actually dropped. But their number of abortions and their government revenue has continued to tick up in their financial reporting. So they're serving less people, making more money. And then to your point, funneling a lot of that money into Democrat campaigns. So this is just all around a bad situation. And I'm optimistic and hopeful that Congress will begin to chip away at this. I think it's a little too optimistic to expect them to just completely cut this off. But Tessa, don't you think it's completely reasonable to expect Congress to do something here? Even if it's looking at some of the discretionary funding, we've got to cut anything and everything we possibly can while we have Trump in the White House.
Well, I think there's a lot here for Congress to take a look at. And certainly that trend that you pointed out with fewer patients served, fewer total services provided, fewer centers around the country, while abortions continue to increase, profits continue to increase, and government funding continues to increase. So it's kind of a concerning trajectory there that we've seen over the past several annual reports that Planned Parenthood has published. And we can see, even just looking at the services that they provide, that abortion is the bulk of what they do. We took a look at Charlotte Loser Institute at what we would call pregnancy resolution services, or what is Planned Parenthood offering regarding pregnancy or the end of a pregnancy. And we looked at abortion, adoption referrals, prenatal care, and miscarriage care. And amongst all those services, abortion accounts for 97%. So if you're a pregnant woman and you're looking for care for Planned Parenthood, Planned Parenthood's main focus is abortion. It's in the most recent annual report, Planned Parenthood reported that they performed 228 abortions for every one adoption referral.
Wow.
So pushing abortion as opposed to other options.
Yeah, they're 100% in the culture of death here. There's no doubt about it, and their numbers prove it out. This is a radical pro-abortion outfit that makes up the bulk of what they do, and everybody saying anything else is just straight up lying and countering the data. Hey, Tessa, tell our folks where they can check out your website over at the Charlotte Loser Institute.
You can find all our research at loserinstitute.org. That's L-O-Z-I-E-R institute.org.
All right. Hey, Tessa, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. That's Tessa Cox. She's a senior research associate over at the Charlotte Loser Institute. And as she mentioned, loserinstitute.org, L-O-Z-I-E-R institute.org. We appreciate her coming on. Folks, these stats are absolutely shocking when you look at the amount of abortions Planned Parenthood is providing. And they're the largest. They're the big bad actor. There are others. There are other abortion providers, but not near as large as Planned Parenthood. And the fact that this has become this, you know, Democrat machine basically is just egregious to its core. And this is why, this is just one of 100 reasons why we have to stop funding this garbage. The first reason is because it's wrong. It's immoral. It's objectively wrong. Babies are dying through Planned Parenthood's business. And it makes up the majority of what they do is to kill babies and call it abortion or reproductive rights or whatever kind of name they want to call it. Abortion is what they do. And then on top of that, if that's not enough, which it is, these are political machines. I mean, can you imagine? The left would cut off the spigot of funding if the Republicans had created some backway deal to fund money to the tunes of billions to these, quote, organizations, only for that money to be funneled right back into political campaigns. I mean, can you imagine if AFA was receiving $700 million in federal money and then we're spending hundreds of millions in political campaign contributions to Republicans? No, the left will be furious. And they would cut off the spigot overnight. But this is exactly what happens on the left. And it's not just with the abortion industry. This stuff happens with the teachers' unions too. The teachers' unions get federal, the districts get federal money. These teachers are coerced to say, oh yeah, you've got to sign up for the union, even though legally you don't in many states. And then that money for the teachers' unions isn't going to the classroom. It's not even going to the administration. It's going straight to the union pockets. And they're using that to fund the Democrats. And what's so bizarre about it, and what's so, there's a lot of grievances here, but these entities don't even pretend to be partisan. I'm sorry, to be bipartisan. They don't even pretend. Like if you go to Apple Corporation, or if you go to Nike, or if you go over to Google, you go to some of these major multi-billion dollar corporations, and you look at their campaign contributions, they're funding Republican campaigns and they're funding Democrat campaigns. And probably equally when you look at the PAC contributions and the super PAC contributions. And so you look at that and you go, okay, these are businesses, you know, they're funding campaigns of both parties because they wanna curry favor with both political parties. Right? For whether it's for tax incentives or regulations or whatever kind of they're trying, whatever their interest is. But you look at the teachers' unions, you look at Planned Parenthood, and some of these mega Marxist left wing Democrat machines, they're nearly 100% Democrat funding. They're funding all Democrats, hardly any conservatives or Republicans. And I think our tax dollars just should be tied up in this stuff. We'll see you next time. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show. That's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you. We need to save them. That is why we have partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears the heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies, and that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28. Or 140 helps rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just call #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.